The next case before the court is Hornbeek v. McDonald, case number 161682, appeal from the Court of Veterans Appeals. All right, 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, please.
Ready? Okay, you may begin.
So please, the court, my name is Sandra Booth. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant, Norma Hornbeek. In the court below, Mrs. Hornbeek challenged the legal sufficiency of the evidence that the board relied upon in finding that her husband was not credible about his travel to Nagasaki. In particular, she challenged the board's reliance on an absence of evidence in the records without the foundation to show that that event would normally have been recorded had it actually occurred. The court declined to review that, declined to apply that rule of law. That brings that issue squarely within this court's jurisdiction under 7292A, the rule of law jurisdiction, as well as the court's interpretation in Wilsey that a failure to apply the rule of law is a prima facie legal claim over which...
But if what the Veterans Court did was essentially say, we're not going to rely on, or we won't, we'll look at all the facts and all the decisions of the board separate and apart from the absence of the service record evidence, mm-hmm. and then found that even having referred to the service record evidence or the absence of the service record evidence was not prejudicial error. Are we allowed to review a conclusion of the Veterans Court regarding what constitutes prejudicial error or not?
I think that this particular question, Your Honor, more accurately, can you review whether the Veterans Court had the jurisdiction to make that initial finding of fact regarding the sufficiency of the evidence on an altered evidential landscape from what the board had relied upon? The board's decision at page 30 of the appendix relies on three pieces of evidence taken together. If we back out the reliance on the absence of records, we're left with what, in my view, are two very weak reads upon which to base particularly if you can, in light of the board's obligation to consider all other evidence and consider the application of the benefit of the doubt, it's a very thin read to support a negative credibility finding. Now, the board may well make that finding. I don't think it will without the official records. It may, but that was not within the scope of review.
But it seems to me you're making one of two arguments then. You're either arguing that the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims made an error in making a harmless error finding, which I don't think we can review, or you're arguing that the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims doesn't have the power to make a harmless error determination. Are you making either of those two arguments? Because it sounded to me like when you started, you were saying that. Uh-huh. And then when you finished, you were saying, well, there's no way that this is really harmless error. The board surely would have found differently.
Well, it's not harmless error, Your Honor, because this is somewhat analogous to the AZ case, where this court, upon remand, cautioned the Veterans Court that it needed to consider whether or not it had whether it needed to remand to the board for additional fact finding in view of the change in the nature of the evidence.
But the Court of Appeals made that determination, did it not, when they said that we find that there's no prejudicial error here, even if the board was wrong with respect to the legal issue that you've raised?
I don't believe the board or the court could make that finding of no prejudicial
error. Well, that's my question. Are you saying that the court doesn't have the power to make that kind of harmless error determination? Because that's what it was, right? It was a harmless error determination that the court made. I'm right about that, am I not? You seem to be resisting that. That's certainly what I read into portion of the court's opinion.
What I'm saying, what Mrs. Hornby contends, is that the Veterans Court did not have, it was not within the Veterans Court scope of review, as construed by the Hensley case, to make the initial finding of fact that one piece of evidence was sufficient to render the veteran's credibility, to render a negative credibility finding, whereas the board itself required reliance on all three pieces of evidence, two of them being one, a perceived inconsistency in the veteran's statement that he went in to Nagasaki and another time reporting that he came back out, and the court did not even address that one. The other being the veteran's admitted error about the specific date that he went to Nagasaki. However, that error, the error in his date, as he recalled, and the actual date that we know his ship was docked at Sasebo, are all within the regulatory time period.
I thought I knew what the legal question is that you were appealing, but now I'm kind of confused. Can you state clearly what's the legal question that we're here to review?
Your Honor, we would like the court to require the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims to address the legal insufficiency of the evidence, the absence of record evidence. And if that determination is favorable to Mrs. Hornbeek, then the Veterans Court will have to determine the question that would be, does the Veterans Court have jurisdiction to make new findings of fact?
So are you arguing that a credibility determination could not have been made because there were missing records?
No, I'm not arguing that it under the facts of this particular case, I'm not saying a credibility determination could not have been made. We're saying that in reaching that decision, the board relied on evidence that was not reliable. And the question then is...
But the evidence it relied on were inconsistency in the statements. It didn't find credible the testimony or the evidence, the statements made by the family members.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an inconsistency in the veteran's own recollection.
Well, the question then is, are those inconsistencies, with regard to the family members, they were disregarded because the veteran's testimony was disregarded, was excluded because of the credibility finding.
Your argument is that if there were records out there somewhere that would show that he indeed did have duties in Nagasaki.
I would argue there is evidence in the record which, under 1154A, the board must consider in light of the circumstances of his service. We actually know very, very little about his service. There is a gap. We know that he went to Beach Battalion School. We know he had amphibious training, both facially suggesting that he was trained to do something that was off of his ship. In February 1945, we know he was assigned to the USS Fallon. The record then goes dark for the next 8 or 9 months until he is back in California. The only way we know that he was in Sasebo is that when he returned to California, he got that stamp on one of his personnel records, and independently, the board has confirmed through other sources that his ship docked at Sasebo on two different occasions. We are otherwise without any evidence other than the veteran's testimony as to what he actually did in the service, where he traveled. We don't even know where his ship docked other than once it left California in February until it returned in October, let alone know where the veteran himself performed his duties. So if
But isn't that precisely the point here, that if you only have so many, if that's all you have, mm-hmm. is the veteran's own mm-hmm. statements, and those statements are found not to be credible for a whole variety of reasons, then you don't have anything that satisfies the burden of proof, right?
If the credibility decision stands, then I think that is correct. But the question is whether that credibility decision can stand on the basis of evidence which is not reliable under the AZ case.
Could I return to the point that we were discussing earlier? And I don't mm-hmm. want to beat this into the ground, but I want to make sure I understand what your legal point is with respect to whether the Veterans Court has the authority in appropriate case, well, in any case, mm-hmm. that it decides to apply the harmless error rule to do so, whether it has that authority.
I think it does have that authority.
Okay, so if it were to I'm sorry, I cut you off. You were going to say under certain circumstances?
Yes.
Or, i.e. only when it does so correctly? Is that?
Well, one would hope.
Well, but that's important because you could have a harmless error determination, which in itself presumably wouldn't be reviewable by us, even if it's wrong, right?
That's true, but I think this is comparable to the AZ case, where if the record is altered by the decision that certain portions of the evidence that the board relied on are not reliable, then we have a real question of whether or not what remains. If you take out of the mix the absence of evidence in the record as substantive negative evidence, which is how it was treated by the board, if you take that out of the mix,
right.
then there really are just two circumstances, two items of evidence that the board relied on. Number one, the inconsistencies in the dates.
Right.
And number two, the an inconsistency that I think would bear further explanation by the board about going in and coming back out.
But isn't that going to be present in every harmless error inquiry where you say there may have been an error with respect to one aspect of the case, mm-hmm. but we think it wasn't prejudicial because the other evidence was amply sufficient to support the board's determination? That is the essence of harmless error determination, is it not?
I don't think you can reach that. I don't think the Veterans Court could have reached that because the board...
Could have as a matter of its power or could have as a matter of logic?
As a matter of its jurisdiction because... I'm sorry.
Well, I come back. It sounds to me like you're saying they don't have the authority to make a harmless error determination. Because in this case, suppose there were 30 items of evidence in addition to mm-hmm. the records issue, mm-hmm. and they said the evidence is overwhelmingly strong that he wasn't there, but the board relied on this records business, and we think they were wrong in that regard. But otherwise, it's clear that the error is harmless. You think they don't have the authority to do that? They have to send it back to the board?
I think when the decision on that issue implicates the application of the benefit of the doubt, that the Veterans Court does not have the jurisdiction to make that initial finding of fact based on the new evidential landscape. And particularly in this case where the absence of records was given, a great reliance was the board placed great reliance on the absence of records. So, if the board should not have relied on that, could not have relied on the absence of records, then we're left with two items of evidence that by themselves are not. It's questionable as to whether they're persuasive. Do they preponderate?
Okay. We'll give you 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Excuse me. May it please the Court. Certainly understandable that Ms. Hornbeek is attempting to find some sort of legal argument that this Court would have jurisdiction to review. But as Your Honors correctly articulated the issue. The issue here is not whether the Veterans Court made a finding of an initial finding of fact contrary to what the board found and what the board relied on, but whether the court correctly applied the rule of prejudicial error. Here,
but didn't, I mean, really, the court did say, all right, the board relied on three things, and one of the things the board said is that you have to look at weaknesses in his testimony or problems like the psychiatric disability and compare that or add it to the absence of service records. And so ultimately the board really did base its credibility determination, at least in part, on an improper consideration. Now, when the Veterans Court then says, we're going to take that improper consideration off the table, how did they then do the weighing that the board itself did? How does the Veterans Court have the authority to do that weighing in the first instance?
Well, if I may address a factual kind of underpinning of Your Honor's comment, the board actually did make the very finding that Ms. Hornbeek alleges it did not. The board made, on page 30 of the appendix, the board actually found that where a ship was stationed, the type of where an individual stationed on that ship actually served is the type of information that one would expect to be in military records, both the location of the ship and the veteran's service records. And there, the board noted, the veteran service personnel records in the DTRA report clearly indicate he actually landed at Sasebo, Japan. In fact, the server records document the veteran participated in the initial occupation of Sasebo on September 22nd to 23rd, 1945. The absence of an entry in a record may be evidence against the existence of a fact if it were ordinarily to be recorded. So here, the board made the very determination that Ms. Hornbeek alleges is missing and alleges constitutes legal error. The Veterans Court reviewed the board's decision for clear error, determined whether its credibility determination, its decision was supported by the record, and found on the basis of the inconsistencies in Mr. Hornbeek's statements alone that it was, that there was no clear error. The Veterans Court addressed Ms. Hornbeek's arguments in order. The first one being the inconsistencies in Mr. Hornbeek's statements were not enough, or that was incorrect, and found that those in and of themselves were enough, therefore declining to reach the rest of, or to address specifically the rest of Ms. Hornbeek's arguments before the Veterans Court. The Veterans Court said, I don't have to. The issue is whether it's clear error. This is not clear error. Whether there is some sort of legal wrongdoing below is irrelevant. Again, it's not harmless. So again, Your Honor's correctly articulated the issue here. It's not whether there was a finding of fact in the first instance, but whether there was an application of harmless error.
But I'm not sure you've fully addressed Judge O'Malley's question. As I think Judge O'Malley was saying, she speaks for herself very well, but I think she was saying, didn't the board's finding with respect to the records issue somehow infect its determinations with respect to the credibility issue? And if so, is it inappropriate for the court to have then teased them apart and treated them as if they were independent grounds of determination? Your response was in significant part that, well, the board was right in looking at the records, but we have to assume at this point for purposes of the argument about harmless error that the board was wrong, and then ask whether nonetheless the court was right in saying that the error was harmless because of the credibility issues. So what I need to hear you say is where we can determine from what the board has said that the credibility issue was quite independent of the records issue.
Well, at first, Your Honor, would note that the board did say, taking all of these facts together, that they find the weight of the evidence is actually against a finding that the veteran didn't serve within 10 miles of Nagasaki. So the board didn't conflate the service records and the DTRA report and the veteran's statement for the purpose of reaching the credibility issue.
I mean, when you say they didn't conflate, they said these things all taken, and they didn't say, they just said inconsistencies in his statements, as well as the lack of documentation of the claimed service and the service records, and the findings in the DTRA report taken together. So how do we separate them?
Ms. Hornbeek is complaining about the credibility determination and is saying that the board somehow relied on the inconsistencies in Mr. Hornbeek's statements, plus the fact that his statements contradicted his service records.
Going back to page 30,
mm-hmm.
and there again, and this is in furtherance to what Judge O'Malley just read, it says, as such, the absence of the entry in the service record is evidence against this claimed service in this case. And then it goes on and uses that evidence in order to build a lack of credibility case. How can that be evidence? The lack, and it did, it cites a case and says that this type of record would have been ordinarily recorded. It's kind of like the presumption of regularity it's trying to apply here in an evidentiary manner, but I didn't find anything else that says that there's evidence that this type of entry would have ordinarily been recorded. In fact, it seemed like the whole venture was recorded pretty well.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm not sure if I understand, and I certainly don't want to fail to
okay,
answer
well,
questions.
Okay, let me go back and just go back to the fact that it seems to me that the board used the absence of the entry of the service record, whether he went to Nagasaki or not, that absence as evidence that weighed against him.
Yes, it did. And that certainly was, again, there were three pieces of evidence that the board looked at. And I understand the concern that the Veterans Court only fully addressed the first of those pieces of evidence that supported the board's determination that the veteran had failed to establish service within 10 miles of Nagasaki. But that is exactly what the rule of prejudicial error is. It's clear error. It's finding, is it clearly erroneous? Based on the first prong is enough to support the board's finding. That is what the rule of prejudicial error is. That is what the Veterans Court did. If the Veterans Court was required to address every single issue, every single piece of evidence the board considered, every single argument that the veteran raises before it, even if on the basis of one fact alone, that is, the board's ruling is not clearly erroneous, there would be no rule of prejudicial error. Then the Veterans Court would be required, again, to address every single finding the board made, every single argument that an appellant makes before it. That would effectively vitiate.
Well, maybe you could say that instead of saying that the lack of an entry is weighs against the veteran, to say that it has no weight at all.
The Veterans Court or the board, Your Honor?
The board.
The board could have done that. The board didn't do that here. But again, I mean, I guess we could say that the board would have to say, kind of articulate it in that manner. But again, the question is whether the Veterans Court appropriately applied the rule of prejudicial error. I believe here the Veterans Court had the authority to do that. It appropriately did that. We hear that this is analogous to AZ, but again, in AZ, that was remanded because the Veterans Court actually relied on an absence of information. This court said that was incorrect. You can't rely on that absence of information. You need to remand. The evidentiary landscape has changed, as Ms. Booth said. You need to remand to figure out what to do in light of the fact that the evidentiary landscape changed. Here, the evidentiary landscape hasn't changed. It's simply one prong was enough. We don't need to address, the Veterans Court doesn't need to address the other issues because this one prong is enough. Nothing has changed. Again, it's the application of the rule of prejudicial error, not a finding of fact in the first instance, not looking at the evidence, weighing the evidence in any different way, simply saying this is what the board found, that is enough. That is not clearly erroneous. And again, we've been talking a lot here about, just bring to the court's attention, about the evidence, about the weighing of evidence, about the credibility of the evidence. This case is about whether the Veterans Court appropriately reviewed, applied the appropriate legal standard, whether the board's credibility determination was clear error.
Do you think that the determination of harmless error is appropriately done by the reviewing court by determining whether there was sufficient evidence other than the questionable evidence that could have supported the lower tribunal's determination? Or is it the question of whether the lower tribunal surely would have reached the same conclusion based on the limited subset of evidence that it was appropriate for it to consider? Do you understand the question?
I believe I do, Your Honor. And again, I don't want to waste anybody's time by answering a question other than what was asked. I do believe that when the Veterans Court is applying a clearly erroneous standard, the appropriate determination is whether the record supports the board's determination.
Even if the board had said, for example, that, which it didn't, but had it said that the factor that impresses us the most and on which we think this case most clearly turns is the absence of any record, but there was the inconsistency, would it be appropriate for the Court of Appeals to have said, yeah, but the inconsistencies in his statements are sufficient to uphold the determination of the board? Would that be an appropriate mechanism for prejudicial error determination?
I think it would be. It's a closer call. It's certainly a more, for lack of a better word, a more disturbing application. Not wrong word, but it's what I've got right now. But it's certainly something that the court could do. If the court is looking at the record as a whole and looking at the determination and looking at the evidence, again, the evidence that the board relied on and said this is appropriate,
but
this is enough.
What about the overlay of the benefit of the doubt rule? So say the board has three reasons and one of them falls out because it was an inappropriate reason. How do we know whether or not in the absence of that third prong, the board wouldn't say, well, then given the benefit of the doubt rule, even though there were some inconsistencies in his testimony, we now fall off the fence the other way. Isn't that really up to the board to decide in the first instance?
Well, Your Honor, the benefit of the doubt rule applies when there's kind of parity. So it doesn't weigh, the evidence doesn't necessarily weigh in favor of the Veterans Administration, doesn't necessarily weigh in favor of the veteran. It's kind of like tie goes to the runner in baseball. If you have three reasons and one of them drops out and all you have left are the inconsistencies, I believe Your Honor remarked in this earlier, that the only evidence are statements by the veteran that are themselves internally inconsistent, which is what the board found, which is what the Veterans Court reviewed, then there is no parity. There is no balance for a benefit to go to the veteran. So in this instance, no. If you have three reasons and one falls out and you don't have anything that really weighs in favor of the veteran in and of itself, I mean, again, the only way to make that happen would be for the Veterans Court to have found that the board's credibility determination was erroneous, was incorrect. Again, that's an application of a rule to law. It's a factual determination. So the benefit of that rule doesn't come into play here because there's no balance, that no tie that needs to be decided. Do you have any further questions? Otherwise.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Your Honor, I think it is pertinent to clarify what the board found with respect to occupation. The board relied on the veteran's personnel record, which was stamped that he participated in the occupation of Sasebo. Sasebo being the deepwater port that was closest to Nagasaki after the bombing.
But not within 10 miles.
No, it was 30 miles away. And also it, the, that, that is what the board relied on. That is the fact that the board relied on to say that there is, those records are affirmative evidence that he did not go to Nagasaki. However, that record was created by the Navy in October of 1945 for purposes of, for the Navy's purposes, he did occupy Sasebo. However, the statute and the implementing regulation governing the radiation exposure claims is much more expansive. Under that statute, and the, under the statute as implemented by the reg, the service member need not have actually occupied a particular area within the ordinary meaning of that word. It is sufficient if he participated, or rather if he provided support services to the occupation, even though he may have been assigned to a different unit, may have been assigned to occupy a different geographical area. That was the court's interpretation in the McGuire case.
As long as he went within the 10 miles at some point.
He had to meet right. The other requirements, right? He had to be within 10 miles of Nagasaki. It had to be within that particular time.
Is there any timing requirement? Does it have to have been within August of 45?
No, Your Honor, and that it can be any time, according to the statute and the reg, between August 7, 1945, which is when the bomb was dropped, through a date in July of 1946. That's why we think that the board has to make the initial finding of fact as to whether the one statement that the court relied on, being the differing dates, is sufficient to preponderate against his credibility, where the veteran's error in recalling dates makes no difference on the merits because all those dates are within that regulatory time period. I would also...
was there any record evidence at all that any U.S. troops occupied Nagasaki the month that the bomb exploded?
Not in this record, no.
Presumably no one from the U.S. occupied it until after the surrender, which occurred in September 20th or something. I don't think there was anybody in Nagasaki.
I don't know. I don't know, Your Honor. It's not disclosed by the records.
Well, history would probably be.
Right, right. But it's not disclosed by this claim file. So I don't know. But the important thing, at least from the perspective of the credibility analysis, is that even though the veteran erroneously remembered the specific date, the dates that he did remember are still within that time period, the regulatory time period. Now, will the board find that that's still sufficient to preponderate against the veteran's credibility without the backup of the absence of record? I think there's a good argument to be made that it would not. I don't think the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims could reach that decision and make that finding fact.
All right, you're past your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.